From Arizona to Illinois, Maryland to South Dakota, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, opposition to the terrorist group Hamas is growing even within the boundaries of Gaza. Virginia Allen of the Daily Signal has an update. Republicans won two special elections in Florida this past week, expanding the GOP majority in the House. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with a real story. The Trump administration has done away with discriminatory DEI policies, but have they been replaced by meritocracy? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And the vitriol the left has unleashed against Elon Musk and Doge proves their effectiveness in ending government by the deep state. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Hamas terrorists continue to hold hostages taken during the October 7th attack on Israel. But even within the boundaries of Gaza, opposition to Hamas is growing. Virginia Allen is a senior news producer with the Daily Signal and host of the Daily Signal and Problematic Women podcasts. She joins us now with details. Virginia, welcome to American Radio Journal. Virginia, we're going to talk about Hamas and some protests against Hamas that have been taking place actually within the boundaries of Gaza. Before we get to that, we hear a lot about Hamas. We see demonstrations pro and con. A lot of folks, I think, don't understand exactly what Hamas is. So tell us a bit about Hamas. What are they?
Very straightforward. They're a terrorist organization, and they have been ruling Gaza for almost 20 years. They were first founded as a group, I guess you could call them a group, a terrorist organization, in 1987. Hamas is short for Islamic Resistance Movement. They're a Sunni Islamic political organization. They're militant, and they use fear, terrorism, violence in order to carry out a very extremist Islamic radical agenda. And both Israel and the West at large, particularly America, is their enemy. And they have been very clear in, you know, in their own documents and writing and political rhetoric, religious rhetoric, that it is their aim to destroy Israel. And of course, they made that even more clear a year and a half ago on October 7th, 2023.
As a result of that terrorist attack on October 7th, 2023. Virginia, they took a number of hostages. Regrettably, some have died in captivity. That's an ongoing problem, is it not? They still have some hostages.
They do. So there are 24 hostages who are still believed to be alive in their captivity, and another, I believe, 34 bodies of those who have been deceased. And we have seen, obviously, many be released, some be freed. And at the beginning of this year, there was a peace agreement, a ceasefire agreement, temporary ceasefire agreement. And over the course of about 6 weeks, there were 33 hostages who were released. Eight of those, it was the bodies of hostages. And so for the folks that are still believed to be alive, those 24, the IDF, the Israeli government, America believes that those folks are still alive, but I've had the privilege of talking with a number of family members who still have hostages in Gaza, and they say, you know, it's really a matter of moments, days, hours, that because of the conditions that we know these hostages are being held in, every single minute matters. And it's not guaranteed that these folks are going to come out alive. And that's why there continues, of course, to be such a call for the release of every single hostage, not only those who are alive, but also had the privilege of speaking with family members of hostages whose bodies are being held. And they've told me, you know, we just can't get closure until we have those bodies back and can properly bury them. So this is something that the world continues, of course, to watch, because it is just such a horrific situation. And for Israel, it seems that, you know, they really won't be able to have closure and peace until every single hostage is returned living and those who have been killed.
Of course, here in this country, sadly, have people protesting on behalf of, in support of Hamas, which is really unimaginable, but that's a whole other subject. Within the Gaza Strip, however, there is opposition to Hamas, and that opposition is beginning to manifest itself more and more. Can you describe for us what the circumstances are there?
This has been incredible, and I think the number and just the amount of courage that this is really taking for some individuals who live in Gaza, some citizens, to stand up against Hamas, that really can't be overstated. We saw at the end of March that there were 3 days in a row where hundreds of citizens in Gaza took to the streets and were very vocal about being anti-Hamas, even shouting out, Hamas, get out. Now, this for some folks, they recognize they're putting their lives at risk when they tell Hamas to get out. And actually, the Times of Israel reported over the weekend that there was a young man, a 22-year-old Palestinian man, who had participated in those protests, and that his body was dumped on the steps of his parents' home. And his family believes he was killed by Hamas because he participated in those protests. And still, though, at his funeral on Saturday, or at the end of March, final Saturday in March, there were folks who were shouting Hamas out. And so there's still, I think, this brewing courage among the people who live in Gaza to recognize, yes, maybe we're putting our lives on the line by shouting Hamas out, but if they don't get out, the fighting is going to continue. There will be more destruction, and really, we have no future. That's the critical part. For the people of Gaza, there is no future for them if Hamas continues to rule, because it will be more violence, it will be more fear, it will be more terror. The only path forward for the people of Gaza is for Hamas to be completely dismantled.
Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, of course, has insisted upon that. He has stood strong, an incredible world leader he is. We saw a little bit of, well, actually a lot of wishy-washiness with the Biden administration. As you track this, have you seen more resolve on the part of the United States, on the part of the new Trump administration, to back up Israel and push for the release of all these hostages and the bodies of those who have died?
This has been from the get-go. We saw when Trump, before he was even in office, just after he was held hostage in office, that statement, that bold statement, was enough to really bring all parties back to the table to get an agreement on a temporary ceasefire signed, sealed, and delivered that then ultimately led to the release of 33 hostages, Israeli hostages, including two American Israeli hostages, Sigi Delchen and Keith Segal. So there has been aggressive movement. Trump continues to be very aggressive in his support of Israel, very clear as negotiations continue and there are continued conversations. The U.S. is very much so standing with Israel in a more aggressive way than before. And I spoke in early February with the family members, some of the family members of those hostages, including the family members of Idan Alexander. Idan Alexander is an American Israeli hostage. And they have just been very clear that they're thankful that Trump is using aggressive language. And so many have told me, we wish every single world leader on October 8th, 2023, would have come out with aggressive language, being very clear that if Hamas is going to carry out this kind of activity, and if they don't set every single hostage free, that there will be held to pay. I think many in Israel would like to see even further aggressive action from the United States on this front, because it has been over 500 days now that these hostages have been held in captivity. But Trump has been incredibly clear and sent an incredibly clear message. The message is clear, which is terrorism will not be allowed to rule and reign as long as Trump is in the White House.
We have been talking with Virginia Allen, who is a senior news producer at the Daily Signal, also host of the Daily Signal podcast and Problematic Women podcast. I'll let you explain that.
Problematic Women, it is a conservative women's podcast, and we have embraced that title of problematic, because to the left, to the radical feminist movement, strong conservative women are very problematic. They're not quite sure what box to put pro-family, pro-American, pro-traditional values in. And so we have just embraced that fact. And so we talk about the news, policy issues, pop culture every single Wednesday. Our show releases, and we do it all from a conservative perspective. So you can find the Problematic Women podcast and the Daily Signal podcast wherever you listen to podcasts or on the Daily Signal's YouTube channel.
Virginia Allen of the Daily Signal. Virginia, thank you for taking time to be with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We've had a couple of special elections to vacant seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. We're going to talk about all of that with Scott Parkinson. Scott, great having you back with us.
It's a pleasure to be back, Loman. Thank you.
Two special elections in the Sunshine State, Florida. Democrats made an all-out effort, outspent Republicans by tens of millions of dollars. What was the outcome of all of that?
Yeah, so just to sort of hit refresh for the listeners, in the first congressional district, Matt Gaetz was initially nominated by President Trump to be his attorney general. And after taking a lot of meetings with senators, he realized he wasn't going to have the votes from some of the moderates and the establishment in Washington, D.C. that sort of preferred the status quo, and somebody not as aggressive as Matt Gaetz to be in that position. And rather than come back to the House, he decided not to be sworn into office on January 3rd. And so that created a opportunity for a special election in the first district. And that's sort of the panhandle of Florida, including Pensacola, big military community. And President Trump weighed in early. He endorsed Jimmy Patronis, who was the chief financial officer of Florida, which is basically the state treasurer. And Jimmy had won statewide office before, pretty high name ID. And he, you know, slogged it out there. And this is a bright red congressional district. So we never really thought that this race was at risk. But Patronis did win the special election yesterday. Then when you slide a little bit over to the east, more so in the Daytona area of Florida's 6th congressional district. This is the district that Ron DeSantis used to represent up until 2018 when he was elected governor. And Michael Waltz was the congressman there for the last three terms. Waltz was named by President Trump to be the national security advisor, and that created an immediate vacancy. So he scheduled another special election there. And Randy Fine was a state senator endorsed by President Trump. But the thing about this one was Fine was not from the district. And this one attracted a significant investment from the Democrats nationally. And Donald Trump did a teletown hall rally for Fine. So did Byron Donalds, the candidate for governor in Florida. So did Ben Shapiro. There were really a lot of hands on deck to try to assist Randy Fine over the finish line here. And Fine did prevail. This is great news. It means that Republicans held both of those seats. And, you know, we've been dealing with really slim margins in the House of Representatives for a time. It was 218 to 215. But then we've had two Democrats that have passed away recently. And that's created the 218 to 213 dilemma, where you can still only lose a couple of seats. But by filling these vacant Republican seats, that puts us at 220 to 213 with just those two Democrat districts that will ultimately, I think, be blue seats when those specials are filled. So Republicans have a little bit more flexibility in the House of Representatives when it comes to advancing Donald Trump's agenda and the electoral mandate that delivered that majority in the 2024 election.
Switching now to what happened in the House of Representatives this past week, they adjourned abruptly, but an unusual fight over proxy voting.
The bill that was on the floor was actually the SAVE Act, which would require U.S. citizens to only be able to vote in U.S. elections. And there was this big fight over the rule, the procedure to taking up that legislation, and it included disposing of the discharge petition from Ana Luna that would allow for proxy voting for new mothers and those that are within, like, paternity leave, the male members of the Congress. A lot of controversy in the House right now over whether to allow for proxy voting. You know, many people think you need a constitutional amendment to do that. Obviously, Nancy Pelosi allowed for proxy voting during COVID, and that was abused to a massive degree by the Democrats. You know, some Democrats didn't show up for 6 months or even a year. And, you know, I think that that'll be an issue that continues to get adjudicated in the House. But we need to get the Donald Trump agenda back on track. And that means moving forward with things like the SAVE Act and reining in these rogue judicial judges.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, typically we end with you telling us a bit about the club, so let's do that.
The website is clubforgrowth.org. We're united in economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. Visit us and sign up for free to become a member.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
DEI has been banished by the Trump administration, but it hasn't exactly been replaced with a meritocracy. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains.
Back on Inauguration Day, President Donald Trump vowed to forge a society that is colorblind and merit-based. That's something he said in his inaugural address. And then shortly thereafter, he signed an executive order that began the process of dismantling the government's DEI rules. That's diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now, less than 2 weeks after that, Vice President J.D. Vance's office hired Buckley Carlson, the 24-year-old son of Tucker Carlson, the Fox News host, former Fox News host and the popular conservative pundit, as a deputy press secretary. So I suppose the thing we can conclude from that is that young Buckley can at least be certain that he didn't get that job because of the color of his skin. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Look, the dismantling of the federal government's various so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, those DEI rules, it's been one of the signature efforts of the first 2 months of the second Trump administration. And I am happy to see that happen. Those rules often required that factors like race and gender and ethnicity be considered alongside or even ahead of much more important things when the government was hiring people, promoting people, or handing out taxpayer-funded contracts. And to be clear, the DEI regime was and is, to the extent that it still exists, fundamentally unfair and discriminatory. It was not great when it was part of government policy. It's not great when it's active in the private sector or in nonprofits or universities, wherever you might see it. Anyone who values individual talent over immutable collective characteristics should applaud the fact that DEI's power seems to be fading in the government and in society. And I mean, yes, I'm poking some fun at the hiring of Tucker Carlson's kid in Vice President J.D. Vance's office, but often in ways that matter much more than that. It seems like what Trump has done over these first few months is a long, long way from that restoration of meritocracy that we were promised. You can start with some of the personnel decisions that the administration has made. Now, look, I'm a libertarian. I love the fact that Trump has been trying to reduce the size of the federal workforce, the fact that he's brought in Elon Musk and created the Department of Government Efficiency to do that stuff. That is a laudable goal, even though it's run into some roadblocks in the federal judiciary. But the mass firings that have been carried out by Trump and by the DOGE program seem to have targeted probationary employees first and foremost, those who are on the job less than a year, generally speaking. And that's an arbitrary approach, one that says absolutely nothing about merit. It protects senior employees simply because they've been around longer. It's the sort of last in, first out thinking that you might expect from, say, a teacher's union, and doesn't really seem to do much to promote meritocracy. I think worse than that is the fact that that approach, those mass firings, seem to sit awkwardly alongside last week's big news story. The story, of course, of Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth disclosing sensitive operational details about a military operation in a group chat that included The Atlantic magazine's Jeffrey Goldberg. Now, Goldberg was reportedly invited to the chat by Michael Waltz, Trump's national security advisor, who was then later put in charge of the investigation into how all of that happened in the first place, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me. This week, of course, the White House press secretary said that that investigation is now finished. Case closed is how she described it on Tuesday. And no one has been fired. No punishments seem to have been handed out. The implication here seems pretty clear. Accountability is only for people at the bottom. Meanwhile, people on top seem to get away with whatever they want. And with no accountability, all that talk about meritocracy seems pretty meaningless. You need, in my opinion, both accountability and competition for meritocracy to be a thing that works. And of course, the Trump administration has also been trying to erode competition, not just in the federal government, but in the country at large. The tariffs and trade restrictions that Trump is pursuing are really nothing more than DEI for companies that engage in commerce that the Trump administration favors. If American consumers want to buy a car made in Japan, they shouldn't be punished for that choice. And if an American manufacturer wants to import raw material from Mexico or Canada to build the best gadget, then the president's opinion about that shouldn't matter at all. A free market is the ultimate judge of merit, and every time that Trump substitutes his own preferences or the preferences of central planners in place of the wisdom of consumers, he's working to undermine this very meritocracy that he claims to favor. You could say the same thing about some of the restrictions on immigration that the administration is pursuing. If Trump was truly seeking, as he said on Inauguration Day, a society that is colorblind and merit-based, then we should want more immigration. Legal immigration, of course, but immigrants are, of course, more likely to start businesses than native-born Americans, and they are less likely to draw upon the welfare system. In a meritocracy, immigrants often win, and indeed, that's one of the reasons why America has been the wealthiest and most successful nation in the history of this planet. Writing in the Washington Examiner a few weeks into the Trump administration, Robert Chernin praised what he called a return to meritocracy that does not just benefit one group. He said it would elevate our entire society, ensure that the most capable among us, regardless of our background, are the ones to lead institutions and businesses. He said that most importantly, it would restore faith in the American dream and the work ethic that goes with it, the belief that anyone from anywhere can rise based on their merits. All of that sounds great to me. The Trump administration should do those things. It should try to ensure that anyone from anywhere can succeed, even if they were born in another country, or goodness me, if they want to purchase a product made in Canada. It should pare back. The Trump administration should work to pare back the federal workforce to more efficiently provide services to taxpayers, of course, and it should do so without regard for seniority. And most importantly at all, it shouldn't tolerate incompetence, especially not from those in leadership positions. The Trump administration, rather than restoring meritocracy so far, seems mostly fixated on rewarding friends and punishing perceived enemies. There's a word for that, for sure, but it definitely isn't meritocracy. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of everything going on in and around the Trump administration this week at Reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Elon Musk and Doge have raised the ire of left-wing radicals. That proves they're doing a good job. So says Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The pace of Donald Trump's first 100 days has been dizzying, and he still has 25 days to go. The two boldest initiatives have been his actions and threats on tariffs and creating DOGE, the so-called Department of Government Efficiency led by Elon Musk, in whom the president has vested unprecedented power and authority. The tariff issue has been in constant flux, so the media coverage of it has also been in flux. But the legacy media have settled in on how they should treat the Doge story. Paint Elon Musk as an unelected, reckless madman directing a crew of 20-something techies with no understanding of government, heartlessly slashing America's most revered institutions and programs. It's been hard to find positive coverage of Doge at any of the major media until last week, when Fox News host Bret Baier interviewed Elon Musk and seven of his top aides. The interview is available on YouTube, and I highly recommend you watch it in full. While it's undeniably a friendly interview, it isn't nearly as one-sided as most of the critical coverage or the made-for-TV comments from some Democrat members of Congress and the Senate. Let's zero in on just one, Social Security. These are verbatim quotes. First, Democrat member of Congress from Texas, Greg Kassar. Quote, I'm 100% certain that Elon Musk is looking for an excuse to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid to pay for tax cuts for billionaires. Close quote. A few days later, he said, quote, it's absurd that Elon Musk is trying to eliminate billions of dollars from Social Security. Close quote. Now, careful parsing of his inflammatory rhetoric will reveal that he is not actually accusing Musk and his team of cutting Social Security benefits. Musk has promised to protect benefits, but to cut waste and fraud. Surely Congressman Kassar doesn't mean to imply that he's against cutting waste and fraud. His remarks are therefore disinformation, pure and simple. Then New Hampshire Senator Maggie Hassan said in a televised Senate hearing, quote, Elon Musk and President Trump have set their sights on cutting Social Security, close quote. Note that she, too, was more careful in phrasing her outrage than the average listener would intuitively detect. She doesn't actually claim that Musk and Trump have set their sights on cutting Social Security benefits, does she? But it's clear what she intended to convey. Similarly, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said this, quote, their goal is clear, destroy Social Security from within, unquote. None of these three can be assumed to be uninformed. So the only alternative conclusion is that all three were intentionally dishonest and deceitful. And since all three obviously intended to provoke emotional responses, all three comments can be rightly labeled demagoguery. Shameful. The proposed cuts are in reducing duplication, inefficiency, and even fraud, not benefits. Musk even makes the point that their reforms will actually enhance benefits, both in the present and for the future, by identifying inefficiency and fraud. That's not to say that Elon Musk and the Doge team are all perfect. Musk made a parody of himself when he cavorted with a chainsaw on stage at the CPAC conference. He admits that there have been some mistakes, and he claims that when they're identified, Doge tries to correct them swiftly. But the 90%+ of American voters who did not watch the Bret Baier interview of Musk and his team have never heard their side of the story. I urge all listeners to American Radio Journal, even those who saw it the first time, to go to YouTube and watch the entire interview. There are indeed two sides to the story of what Musk is trying to do through Doge, and we should acquaint ourselves with both sides. The anti-Musk side is easy to find. It's ubiquitous in the major print media, broadcast television, cable television, radio, and podcasts. The Musk side is harder to find, no question about that. But it's not that hard to anyone who has access to YouTube. Simply search for Bret Baier Musk interview. All bureaucracies tend to grow in size, scope, and inefficiency. As one of the Doge team memorably put it, government ratchets in only one direction. Correction requires some breakage. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WMIR-FM and WJXY-AM in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, along with WBSS-AM in Lynnwood, New Jersey. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.